Support comes from WFAE members and Mazda of South Charlotte, committed to Mazda's focus to ensure every element of a car is designed around the driver. More at MazdaofSouthCharlotte.com. This is Charlotte Talks. I'm Mike Collins. In the 19th century, Charles Darwin helped popularize the concept of the survival of the fittest. Well, it wasn't his concept. It was that of economist Herbert Spencer, who, after reading Darwin's On the Origin of Species, saw parallels between his own economic theories and Darwin's biological ones. Darwin wrote about natural selection, in which only the fittest survive, prosper, and reproduce. That means we are all descendants of those fit enough to survive. But perhaps there is another element that neither Spencer nor Darwin considered. Friendliness. That makes sense, doesn't it? I mean, that those who not only survived but prospered exhibited that quality because we all had to work together to claw our way out of the jungle and create a civil society. We had to be able to get along. Those that didn't usually met with an untimely end. Well, many of us, particularly politicians in Washington and Raleigh, seem to have forgotten the need to get along, to cooperate, to get things done. Or at least they've forgotten that to make those things happen, you have to be nice. Enter a new book putting this theory forward, Survival of the Friendliest, Understanding Our Origins and Rediscovering Our Common Humanity. It's the work of Duke University evolutionary anthropologist Brian Hare and his co-author Vanessa Woods, and it suggests that our secret to success as a species is our unique friendliness. And Dr. Hare joins us to fill us in this hour. Welcome to the program.
Thank you, Mike.
Good to see you. Evolutionary anthropologists, as I understand it, and you can tell me where I'm going down the wrong path here. You study mankind's place in nature and how we arose from our primate ancestors and how our distinctive attributes like walking on 2 feet, standing upright, even our brains came to be, our brain size came to be. But you are famous for your studies of dogs and the book, The Genius of Dogs, which really put you in the national spotlight. They are man's best friend, after all, and the word friend is in that sentence. So I'm wondering, if you're right about human success being based on our friendliness, did we get it from the dogs or did they get it from us?
What a fun question. Well, I think dogs actually are exhibit A of how survival of the friendliest works. I think that normally when we think of evolution, we think of the meanest, the biggest, the toughest is the one that is going to be at an advantage. But actually fitness, as you said in your introduction, really is about how many offspring you have. And there's just overwhelming evidence in nature that friendliness is life's winning strategy. And dogs are a great example of this because we know that they became friendlier during their evolution and that in their interactions with us. And I'm sure it rubbed off on us some. Mm. And that's what allows them now to have hundreds of millions of individuals all over the world, while sadly wolves are very endangered everywhere they're found. So I do think that dogs are exhibit A of friendliness, and they have had profound influence on us.
You know, the South is known for friendly people. At least we like to tell ourselves that, and maybe it's true, because before the show started, and I wasn't planning to ask you about this, but you went to Harvard and you taught at Harvard and now you're teaching at Duke. I hope I'm not speaking out of turn here, but you told me that you like teaching at Duke better because the students are nicer than they are at Harvard. Harvard people are supposed to be really smart. Are they not smart enough to know that friendliness gets you places? Are they already at that place because they're at Harvard?
Yeah, my joke has always been that the difference between somebody at MIT and somebody at Harvard is a Harvard person can convince you they're the smartest person in the world. The MIT people actually are. And so the difference between Harvard and Duke, what I've found being at Duke and at interacting with people at NC State and Chapel Hill is it's okay not to know in the cultures, these learning communities. And at Harvard, people were so busy trying to demonstrate that they deserve to be there and that they were the smartest in the world, it was hard for people to admit they didn't know things. And so that led to a lot of unfriendliness. And so really the core of the book is we became a friendlier species. And that allowed us to learn from each other, cooperate, and innovate more rapidly. And so I put my money on the triangle in that respect. And, definitely Southern hospitality should encourage learning, I hope.
Okay. There's another book called Sapiens, A Brief History of Humankind. And historian Yuval, I hope I say his name right, Yuval Harari wrote that book. And he writes about the evolution of all these, of us, but he talks about all these other human-like species, other sapiens, not Homo sapiens, but other sapiens, who shared the earth with us. And he talks about how they're not here and we are, and perhaps why. He has several theories that he puts forth in that book, from driving them into extinction because of our superior skills at hunting and because our development of agriculture, including the discovery of fire, which allowed us to cook food as opposed to eating it raw, which allows you to get more calories out of it, et cetera. I mean, a whole bunch of things that he puts forward in there, including our being mean to them. We didn't like them, so out they went. We overwhelmed them. Could it have been, I guess another is our lack of tolerance. As I just said, we didn't like them. So could it have been a cognitive revolution that he says we had? At some point when our brains got bigger, we also began to think differently and invent things. Was it that cognitive revolution that allowed us to become the dominant?
I think one of the things that that book does well is point out one of the big shifts in our understanding of human evolution in the last 10, 15 years, which is that we were not alone until 25, 50,000 years ago. Mm-hmm. There were 4 to 5 other human species we shared the planet with 50 to 100,000 years ago. They all had big brains. They all were cultural, and they likely had some linguistic ability we would recognize. So our normal story that we tell about why we're different than other animals is, well, we have big brains and we're linguistic or have language and culture. Well, that doesn't really work because there were at least 4 or 5 other species that are all extinct that had those same traits. So if those traits are the things that are so crucial for our success, why are they all dead?
Yeah.
What we argue in Survival of the Friendliest is that actually our species outcompeted the other humans because we were able to work together in a way they couldn't. We were the friendliest species of human that evolved. And it did allow us to outcompete them. Whether we directly did that used violence against other species of humans, particularly an interesting case would be the Neanderthals. I don't think we have direct evidence of that yet. It may just be we were more efficient.
Yeah. He talks about this cognitive revolution. Would happiness perhaps be one of the things that came out of that, or friendliness rather, come out of that?
I could agree that there'd be a cognitive revolution in terms of friendliness driving our ability to innovate and cooperate. So what we think happened was late in human evolution, probably the last 100,000 years, humans that were in our species of humans that were able to form friendships with strangers that they recognized as group members. So strangers who had some marker of identity that was like them, those individuals that were able to form friends with these strangers could then learn from them, could cooperate with them. And it expanded the number of people and ideas that you could encounter. And that would increase our ability to push technology forward. Basically more minds working together, just like on the internet, there's more great ideas and things push forward faster. And other human species were unable to do that. They were stuck in their own little groups and they didn't have group identity. They just knew that other groups were and individuals were unfamiliar and they were scared of them. They didn't want anything to do with them. And so I think that was the key is our ability to form friendships with strangers from other groups that shared our identity.
There are very few major accomplishments in the history of mankind, one would think, that are based on the individual efforts of one person and one person only. They may have had an idea, but to reach the fruition of that idea, they had to work with others. And in many cases, they were people that they didn't know. They met for the first time, business arrangements or just groups. So since we know that, and since it's demonstrably true, how is it that we can't work together today, at least in our politics, to get things done?
Yeah, that's a deep question. And we do take that on. And the, you know, the book is all about how, you know, our friendliness gives us a unique advantage relative to other human species, and that we're the friendliest species that evolved. But we have to deal with the fact that we're also capable of incredible cruelty and intense violence, and, you know, being pretty unfriendly too. So how do you explain that? Well, it ends up that we think that the same mechanism that evolved to allow us to see others with our shared identity as potential friends, even though we didn't know them, that same mechanism can sort of shut off and reduce our compassion, or keep us from seeing other human beings as potentially fully human. Especially if we feel like our group that we love like a family is somehow threatened. And so that's the key psychology, is the same thing that gave us the friendliness can turn off. And when it turns off, directed at a certain group that may be threatening our own, we are capable of tremendous cruelty in the defense of those we love. At least that's what we feel like we're doing.
Do you know what causes that to switch, like a light switch, to turn that friendliness off and make it something altogether different, the antithesis of friendliness?
Yes. Yeah, so there's great research, and increasingly so, working on both how people sort of conceive of strangers and friends, but also how the brain works and what is the underlying neurobiology. So it seems like there's a social network in the brain. So different parts of the brain working together to help us be friendly and social. And we know that those sort of parts of the brain that allow us for reasoning about and consciously thinking about friends and being friendly, that they are connected to our emotional centers and also our body's physiological centers. And that when we feel threatened or scared, whether we're aware of it or not, that social network, the part of our brain that allows us to reason about friends and feel like someone else is like us, those sort of emotional centers can shut down those reasoning centers and turn off our friendliness towards those that we feel threaten us. So I do think we know more about how the brain works and how it turns on for friendliness and how it can turn off.
So when you say someone like us, we've talked about this on other programs, that we don't really know people not like us very well because we don't associate with them. And people not being like us can be based on the color of your skin. It can be based on your educational or economic background. It can be based on what you know, what your field of study is, what your field of work is. So when you say we like people and we're friendly to people like us, what does that mean? And I have 30 seconds. So what does that mean?
Well, I mean, there are markers that can be anything from what we look like to what we believe, how we talk. And we're very sensitive to these things. And if there's something that we recognize as like us, that makes us friends.
Dr. Brian Hare is with us. We're talking about friendliness, our greatest attribute. And we'll come right back and talk more about it in a second on Charlotte Talks. Support for Charlotte Talks comes from WFAE members and Fifth Third Bank, dedicated to the financial empowerment of the community by investing time, resources, and people in the Charlotte area and throughout the state. More at 53.com. It's Charlotte Talks on listener-funded 90.7 WFAE and 90.3 WFHE. I'm Mike Collins. Our guest today is Dr. Brian Hare. He's a professor of evolutionary anthropology, also of psychology and neuroscience at Duke University, and the author with his wife, Vanessa Woods, of Survival of the Friendliest, Understanding Our Origins and Rediscovering Our Common Humanity. Your research tells you that our species became friendlier over time. How do you know that?
Well, when an animal is selected for friendliness, when you have two animals, one that is super friendly, that is put together with another super friendly animal, and they have offspring, and you do this for generations, it doesn't just make the animal, the future population of animals, friendlier. It also changes their bodies. It changes their physiology in surprising ways, but also predictable ways. And so when you select for friendliness, you also change the body, what it looks like and how it operates. And so we can look in human ancestors, extinct human ancestors, and we can look in fossils of our own species and look for the signature of selection for friendliness in the bodies of extinct or archaic or humans. Sorry.
So what would that be? What would the changes, are they noticeable to the naked eye, or what would the changes, physiological changes, be?
I think the most fun one is our faces. We have friendlier faces. So our friendliness is in our faces, literally. Humans have shorter faces, narrower faces than other extinct humans. We also have, if you've ever seen in the museum, sort of the extinct human species, they have these giant sort of cliffs over their eyes. They're called brow ridges. That is another example where that's very much reduced in our species. And we know that when you have selection on friendliness, that it changes the shape of the face, the structure of the face, but it also changes the shape of the skull that houses your brain. And one of the nicest things you can say to somebody based on evolutionary anthropology is, boy, you have a beautiful globular head. Because one of the things that happens...
I don't think I've ever said that.
Yeah, I know. I'm trying to give people a new compliment that they can give each other. Oh, so globular. Your head is very globular, because that means it's very spherical. It's very round. And one of the things that happens when you select for friendliness, Neanderthals, for instance, have a football-shaped head. And when you select for friendliness, you get a rounder shaped head. So we can pick these things up in the fossil record.
So how does that happen? Is it simply that people who began to exhibit these globular heads were more successful at mating with other people who had globular heads, and therefore they produced people with globular heads, and we selected out those who didn't just through reproduction? Is that how it works?
So that's a great question. None of this that I'm suggesting has happened was intentional or purposeful. No one was sort of controlling it. It was the individuals who were friendlier were an advantage, because they could learn from each other and cooperate in new ways. And as a accident of that, these changes to the body occur. We see that in animals, that when you select for friendliness, these changes happen in bodies. As an accidental result. And we know why. It seems like, well, why would that happen? If you select for a behavior or cognition, why would the body change? That doesn't make any sense. But we know that it's because of development. If you want a friendlier animal, you have to change how they mature, how they develop. And you have to change how the brain develops. And to do that, you have to change very early fetal development, the pattern of how a fetus develops. And one of the main mechanisms is to change the hormones or the chemistry that sets up the development of the brain that then allows for friendlier behavior. But the same chemistry or hormones that shape brain development do a lot of jobs early in fetal development, including changing how your bones and your cartilage and other features of our body are put together. So if you change behavior, you're going to have to change development. But if you change the development that leads to a change in behavior, you accidentally change the body too.
Because when you were talking about dogs in interviews that you've done, and also I'm assuming in The Genius of Dogs, one of your other books, you mentioned that we like dogs with floppy ears, because floppy ears make the dog look friendlier to us. Well, the dog doesn't know that. The dog doesn't know that, gee, if I have floppy ears and a wagging tail, they'll like me more. It's just part of what they have become. You're saying that did we purposefully breed them that way, or did we invite them into our world because they had floppy ears and they propagated because we took care of them?
So all the modern breeds that we are familiar with today that have European ancestry, most of the breeds today are European breeds. They're all about 150 to 200 years old. Dogs evolved 15 to 25,000 years ago. So dogs were not much like what we know of today. Dogs would have, for the majority of their history on Earth, would have been like what you think of when you see an Australian dingo. And so what we think happened and think 15 to 25,000 years ago, there's no agriculture. Everyone's living as a hunter-gatherer. Living off the land foraging. And what we think happened is wolves, a population of wolves were attracted to humans. And humans didn't choose wolves. Wolves chose us. We started creating, we do what we do best. We create waste. And there's a lot of waste we create that's very useful to a wolf. And so the wolves that could be attracted to humans, just like coyotes are currently attracted in North Carolina to human settlements, wolves were attracted to humans and started interacting with us. That those that were not fearful were at an advantage because they could use all that waste. And that's then what selected for friendliness. And because morphology is connected to friendliness, as we just talked about through development, the wolves that had that attraction and that friendliness started to change what they look like. Then humans could pick up, oh, these wolves are different than the other wolves. And they don't bother us. They just eat our waste. Who cares? Our garbage and waste. And so they're not competing with us for food. And so then you have the relationship born. And it was all a product of natural selection, not artificial selection driven by humans. So it's not that a bunch of foragers before agriculture went out and said, we should create dogs. Don't you think it would be great? Let's have some, we'll leave the wolves back with our kids for generations while we go hunt. That's just, that can't have happened.
No.
So it was natural selection.
Well, coyotes, we don't like coyotes very much, particularly if you're a farmer or a herder. And even here in the urban environment, we're having this encroachment of coyotes, particularly in the Charlotte area and other animals that traditionally have tended to stay away from us. But you write about the fact that as we urbanize and encroach on their territory, they are becoming increasingly, I'm not sure the word is dependent, but it is, they're less reluctant to be around us. Does that mean in 50 or 100 years or 1,000 years or a millennium that coyotes will be like dogs?
Yes. In a word,
really?
Yes. So that's the prediction. They won't be like artificially selected, because 150 to 200 years ago, people started to actively select and create all the breeds that are represented, say, in the American Kennel Club registry. And even before that, there were certain breeds that had been created in Asia, and there were a few in Europe as well, but not the hundreds that exist today. So I'm not saying it'll be like that. What I'm saying is that coyotes will evolve into something more like a dingo. And so that process is underway today based on the prediction of the hypothesis we put forward. I think we're, and when natural selection domesticates an animal, when it's not human-driven, purposeful domestication, where people are carefully screening and selecting who's going to breed together, and it's just natural selection working, that's called self-domestication, because the species is actually domesticating itself via natural processes. And so that's what's happened with coyotes. I had a thesis student at Duke actually just published, an undergraduate published our first paper working with the Raleigh Museum. Roland Kays has track cameras all over the state. And we measured, we had hundreds of encounters with coyotes. No surprise. We were able to show that coyotes that live in more urban spaces are actually attracted to the cameras. They come inspect them and are interested in them, whereas the more rural or wild coyotes avoid them and run away. So it seems possible that right now coyotes are under strong selection to be attracted to humans and human artifacts when they live near us, and that they're attracted to our waste and our garbage, just like wolves were when they began to domesticate themselves and chose us as their partner.
You know, I've used the word domestication. I'm sure many other people have when they're talking about animals, domestic dogs, domestic cats, as opposed to wild animals. But that self-domestication that you talked about can also be, it also refers to us and what our ancestors did to become friendlier. Would that be accurate? We self-domesticated?
That's the argument, is it was natural selection, that there was an advantage to those who could form friendships with strangers who they recognized as group members. And so if you can have, and we do it all the time, we've done it today. I didn't know you before 30 minutes ago, and now we're best buddies. So we both have an interest in and a curiosity of, topics dealing with human psychology. And so we recognize each other as people interested in that, so we can become fast friends. If we were talking about chimpanzees, a close relative, they just can't do that. They're highly xenophobic. They don't have a concept of group. They don't. They only can recognize others as either familiar or unfamiliar. And if they're familiar, okay, that's my group member. If you're unfamiliar, I'm terrified of you. And so with humans, we have this new way that we can recognize a stranger as marked as like us by some group identity, an interest in something or what we look like, how we talk.
Well, in addition to the study of humans and the study of dogs, you have also studied bonobos. And let's talk about, because you brought up chimps. They are our first and second cousins, chimpanzees and these other apes, the bonobos. Chimpanzees, like us, commit murder. They kill each other on purpose with venal intent. Bonobos don't. Why?
So I think one of the most remarkable beings we share the planet with is the bonobo.
And thank you for saying it correctly. I'm sorry.
Yeah. Oh, no. It's tomato, tomato. You could say okay. Bonobo or bonobo. But I want to make sure people know our relation to them, because it's often stated, and historically it's often stated, that chimpanzees are our closest relative, which is correct but incomplete, because we have two closest relatives, and it's confusing. How can there be two number ones? But there are, because it's more like having two first cousins. You can have two first cousins. One's a girl, one's a boy. They're different from each other, but they're equally closely related to you. And that's how it is with chimps and bonobos. And we're lucky to have both. And bonobos are the most amazing beings. And the reason is, just to restate what you said, no bonobo has ever been observed to kill another bonobo. Chimpanzees have the rate of homicide, or we should say chimpicide, that has been observed in some human cultures. They will raid neighboring territories, and they will systematically target rivals, and they will murder them, and they do it in as gangs of males, and sometimes females join in. They torment their victims, and they eventually, if they can wipe out enough of their neighbors, they'll take over their territory and try to take their females. Well, it seems that that type of aggression has paid big evolutionary dividends in chimpanzee land. South of the Congo River, though, the river that sort of cuts Africa in half through the middle, sweeping through Central Africa and the Congo Basin, south of that river is bonobo land. And bonobos evolved a social system that is completely devoid of the type of aggression I just described. No bonobo group ever attacks or kills a neighboring group. And in fact, if anything, when a bonobo group meets a strange bonobo group, they play and maybe even have sex with each other, and they have a pretty amicable interaction. So it seems that male bonobos in particular have been selected to be friendlier.
And you point out that if you put two bonobos in separate cages and you give one of them food and not the other one, the one with the food will do his or her best to find a way to open that cage so they can share their food with the other bonobo, even if they don't recognize that as being part of their clan. That is remarkable. Now, that is certainly also the definition of friendliness, one would think. But is it friendliness Or is it something else? Because these are not people that, these are not people. That's it. Yeah. They don't have a concept of friendliness.
Yeah. So my definition of friendliness is pretty broad. I think if you even want to be near another entity and you're attracted to them, that's a type of friendliness. You want to interact and you just want to be close to them. It doesn't have to necessarily be intentional or even conscious, and it doesn't even necessarily have to be unselfish. You're being friendly if you want to interact with somebody because you feel good about it, or maybe you even benefit. And that's taking an evolutionary perspective. Your question about the bonobos, though, is a good one, because it is quite remarkable. Are they being good Samaritans, or is there something going on there where they're trying to benefit? And so we do have some evidence that first, that when bonobos are given the choice between sharing with someone they know or their family member and a complete stranger they've never met before, they prefer to share with a stranger. They want to eat together and share food or help someone they don't know. Wow. So that's pretty remarkable, because yeah, we've sort of done the same thing with humans, and that's actually not what humans do. Humans would prefer to share with a group member or a family member. So they really are quite remarkable. That's why I love sharing the planet with them, because yeah, I think they give us hope of,
Well, because they're better people than we are.
Yeah, well, I didn't want to say it, but they kind of are better people than we are, kind of like our dogs are. If only we could be as good.
But there are all kinds of creatures that have these relationships, like elephants benefit from certain insects being on their backs, and we have flowers who are pollinated by other insects and birds, and that's not friendliness. They're sharing their pollen because they're not aware that they're sharing their pollen, but it's necessary for them to do so to propagate. But that's a symbiotic relationship. That's not friendliness. So where do you draw the line? How do you distinguish, particularly when it's not a human, between the two?
So I actually, from, if you take a biological perspective or a perspective looking at life, and you ask sort of where is success, I actually think that flowers pollinate and giving food to pollinators is an example of friendliness.
Okay. Wow. All right. Unconscious friendliness. When we come back, we're going to talk about something else. My finger's been in the air because I've been telling him to wrap it up. That's the wrap-up signal when your finger twirls. There's something else this finger does that makes us uniquely human. We'll talk about that when we come back. Support comes from WFAE members and Mazda of South Charlotte, committed to drivers that share Mazda's passion that cars make driving matter. More at MazdaofSouthCharlotte.com. It's Charlotte Talks on WFAE and WFHE. I'm Mike Collins. Dr. Brian Hare is with us. He's at Duke University, where he's professor of evolutionary anthropology, psychology, and neuroscience. Smart guy. And the author of The Genius of Dogs and also The Survival of the Friendliest, which is what we're talking about today, understanding our origins and rediscovering our common humanity. Back to the humans side of this equation and your observations about us. You say that at around 9 months old, human infants begin to point. And you say this is a curious gesture that no other animal does. What's the significance of the fact that an infant will begin to point?
So all of us, around 9 to 12 months, begin to understand that when someone gestures with pointing or looking in a different direction, trying to indicate something to us, that individual pointing to us is trying to communicate what they want, or that they know something, or they see something that might be helpful to you. And it's really our first window into the minds of others. We understand that others think and know, and they can think and know things that we don't know. And that's really an amazing ability. And all of our linguistic and cultural accomplishments are built on.
And you point out that when parents begin to point at their infants, at first the infant's gaze will be on the finger that you're pointing. But at some point in their life, they begin to not look at the finger, but where the finger is pointing toward, what it's pointing toward. When does that happen, and what does that tell us, and how does that relate to friendliness?
Yeah, so 9 to 12 months, kids really start following the direction of a point, and we think that that's a great measure that they are understanding what's going on inside the minds of others, that they're no longer just sort of responding to behaviors and sort of reflexively, you know, not really knowing what's going on in your head. But by 9 to 12 months, all of us started to understand, hey, if he's pointing or she's pointing for me, she's trying to help me see something or know something I don't know. And then that everything else is built on that. All of our social interactions, all of our culture, et cetera.
Dogs will do that too. If you put, I saw something yesterday, it may have been something from one of your videos, I'm not sure, where if you are standing in front of a dog and you put two treats down on either side of you and point to a treat, the dog will most likely pick up that treat first.
That's right. So that was the big surprise, was I was an undergraduate and I was working with my undergraduate advisor, and he told me about the pointing of human infants and how that was a unique feature. Only humans do that. And having been raised by a Labrador retriever named Oreo, who was my best friend growing up, I couldn't help but say, I think my dog does that. And so that's how we got really excited. He got really excited. We both got excited about studying this in dogs. And it ends up that dogs, fast forward 20 years, we know based on a lot of research that dogs understand gestures and pointing with the same depth that a 9 to 12 month old infant does. And that they really are thinking about what we're thinking. They're trying to understand what we want when we point. And it's not just that they learn some simple parlor trick. They really do understand, and they're trying to communicate with us.
Well, I just said that you say it's a gesture that no other animal does, but don't dogs also point? I mean, there are hunting dogs that will freeze and look in the direction of the prey. So isn't that a form of pointing?
Yeah, there's a breed called, there's a whole set of breeds called pointers.
Yes.
So I've actually been bird hunting before in my life and worked with pointing dogs, and they surely do point where a covey of birds are hiding. It's, you know, I think that dogs are a great example, though. Back to the friendliness question, what does this have to do with friendliness? What we figured out was that why dogs have this ability that is crucial to being human, because basically if you don't develop this ability to understand pointing, you're going to have a lot of developmental delays across a lot of your social skills. And so we know it's essential that kids start pointing and understanding pointing to become a normally functioning human. And what dogs allowed us to do, though, given that they have similar abilities, is to study how they acquired those abilities. And we know that when you select for friendliness, and we talked about the bodies changing, you get shorter noses and curly tails and floppy ears and all these things that change, you also get the ability to understand human pointing.
You call this development in children of the understanding of what a point means and how to follow it, the theory of mind, that they're becoming aware that you have intent, that and they're trying to understand what you want, and they want you to understand what it is they want, and it's all done, at least initially, nonverbally through this pointing. That seems very sophisticated and yet innate. So something else that it is innate, evidently, because you've studied it, is friendliness. Why is it so difficult, then, for some people to follow their grandmother's advice that you catch more sugar, or that flies get, you catch more flies with sugar than with vinegar? Why is that so difficult for us to remember?
I see. Yes. Well, this goes back Sorry. To something we were talking about earlier.
Yes.
There's a paradox. We are the friendliest species, but we are also capable of intense cruelty. And it goes back to the fact that what allowed us to be successful is our ability to follow gestures, to think about what others are thinking, to have this theory of mind, and to imagine what it's like to be someone else and put ourselves in their shoes. But it's actually this exact same mechanism we talked about earlier. I said, it turns off when we feel threatened and the ones we love, our group we identify with, is threatened. That's the mechanism. It's theory of mind. It's the ability to empathize and that then allows for compassion. That's what gets turned off when we feel threatened. And we know based on some neurobiological or work on the brain that this is what happens.
So I mentioned at the very beginning that it was Charles Darwin and his On the Origin of Species that gave rise to the survival of the fittest theory, which was not his, it was somebody else's, it was an economist's. And you say that no folk theory of human nature has done more harm or is more mistaken than the survival of the fittest, the idea that the strong and ruthless will survive while the weak perish became cemented in the collective consciousness. But somewhere along the way, fitness became synonymous with physical fitness. All of these attributes that would make you stronger, bigger, better, more able to bully, etc. And that became the basis of social movements like free market economies, extreme views of free market economies, and corporate restructuring. Expand on that. Is that our problem, our contemporary problem today, that we prize being mean and efficient over everything else, including friendliness?
I certainly think that one of the core principles in biology has been used to justify extreme political ideologies or economic ideologies. And it's a misunderstanding of biology. Again and again, we see that the most success in life is through friendliness and cooperation. So the idea that you have to be mean or big or alpha to be successful is really ridiculous if you're trying to use science to justify that. So I think really it's that idea, that misconstrual of survival of the fittest is really just people who have a worldview and they're trying to take the science and justify their worldview by perverting what the science actually says.
If you believe in survival of the fittest, then it's easy for you to say, well, they didn't succeed or they're in penury because they didn't try.
Yeah,
it's not the system. It's not the economic system that's keeping them down. It's themselves.
That's right. Oh, they, you know, somehow there's something wrong with that person or that group of people. And it tends to be people who are attracted to that idea tend to have a very strong belief in group hierarchy, that they're groups that are superior and inferior to other groups, that tend to be, more likely have a stronger tendency to dehumanize or not see other individuals as fully human. So I do think that there are people who are attracted to that misunderstanding or misuse of the phrase that was never meant to justify seeing some humans as more valuable than other humans. That's not what survival of the fittest means in biology. It just simply means that there are certain species or certain traits that allow you to have more offspring. And I'm telling you that friendliness is the winning strategy in life.
And it's also a strategy to have a more relaxed life, if you're correct, because you say that this misunderstanding of the survival of the fittest is a terrible survival strategy. It leads to a lifetime of stress, and that friendliness is the more powerful strategy. Why?
By far. It's not even close. Yeah, there's beautiful work showing that people's social networks, and of course, we're all so sensitive to it now because we're supposed to be socially distancing. Unfortunately, it should have been called physically distanced, because we all need to be closer socially in tough times like this, because it's our social networks that buffer us from stress. And there's lots of evidence from animals and humans that people who have friends that can support them are much better in terms of their health, their personal health, and their personal happiness, and all sorts of other measures that are positive. So absolutely, friendliness is the winning strategy, both on a personal level and when you're thinking more biologically.
But friendliness, as you've mentioned several times, has a dark side, and it's the flip side of the same coin. If you flip the coin over, we can get really mean and nasty and torturous. Witness what happened in World War II with the Nazis. They were able to dehumanize millions of Jews and kill them because of their ethnic heritage. How can that be? And can we suppress that in ourselves? Can we come to recognize what's going on and take a step back and go, whoa? Can we recognize it?
It's the most important question you could ask me. And I think it's the most important question we all need to be wrestling with. So we try to take this on. And our answer is that based on the best evidence, it seems that all of us have the capability to dehumanize. While we are built for friendliness, our brains are built for friendliness. Our brains are also built to protect those who we love. And one of the ways we protect those who we love is we turn off the friendly parts of our brain, and those groups that we feel threaten our own loved ones, we don't see as fully human. And all of us have that possibility, all have that capability. And so then your question is, well, how do we make sure that doesn't happen? Because our democracy depends on it, that yes. We see each other as fully human and equally valuable as citizens. How do we do that? There is wonderful evidence that cross-group friendships, so friends across different groups, whatever those groups are, whether they're religious or, you know, economic or, you know, sports teams, whatever it is, or race, ethnicity, if they're friends across different groups, true friends, though, not just people you know or you wave at or you're familiar with, I mean friends, that those friendships buffer against the worst of human nature.
You know, we heard this last night. If anybody watched the Democratic National Convention, in the piece that they ran about John McCain and his friendship with Joe Biden, which crossed the aisle. And 20 years ago on this program, we used to have South Carolina Congressman John Spratt on this program on a regular basis because he represented York County in South Carolina. And he bemoaned the decline of friendships among members of Congress, because in the old days, they would stay in Washington over the weekend and they would socialize with each other, Democrats and Republicans. They would get to know each other, and it became impossible to treat them as other during the course of doing business in Congress. Well, now they go home to fundraise. They never meet each other, and they're strangers to each other. And that's exactly what you're saying. That's part of our problem, right?
I would say that it is the root cause of the problem in democracy today, is that the breakdown of cross-group friendships, both among citizens and the political establishment, elite, et cetera. And I think my number one, if you asked me, hey, here's a small pot of money, how could you have the biggest bang for your buck to fix for the future and prevent the worst? And the worst would be that we dehumanize each other and fracture and actually start intentionally doing terrible things to one another in a violent way. How would you prevent that? What would be the number one thing you would do to support democratic institutions in the United States? I would make sure immediately that congressional staffers, and not everybody realizes when everybody says Congress, they think of the representative, they think of the senator, the individual that was voted for. But there's actually an entire office full of young 20-year-old people who volunteer or are paid almost nothing to live in one of the most expensive cities in America to represent us and work themselves to the bone. And I would make sure that those young people who are the future lawyers, the future judges, the future politicians, lobbyists, that they are friends with people from the other party. And I would do that by making sure they go to lunch together. And maybe that means we need to subsidize lunch for these people who aren't very well paid otherwise, so they become fast friends at a young age and for decades will be buffered against the worst of human nature.
Or we could elect bonobos. They'd be nice to each other.
Yeah, well, that's another strategy, yes.
Dr. Brian Hare, professor of evolutionary anthropology, psychology, and neuroscience at Duke University, and author of, with Vanessa Woods, of Survival of the Friendliness, Understanding Our Origins, and Rediscovering Our Common Humanity. Thank you very much for the hour. Support comes from WFAE members and Mazda of South Charlotte, dedicated to those who believe a car should stir one's emotions and deliver a heightened state of driving. More at MazdaofSouthCharlotte.com.